This is The Interchange Recharged. I'm David Banmiller. We typically focus on the big stories in energy coming out of the U.S., but a lot is happening in the Asia-Pacific region. As we've seen around the world, fossil fuel demand is increasing as countries prioritize energy security over decarbonization efforts. The potential is there, however. More than $3 trillion is expected to be pumped into renewable power generation over the next decade. How can Asia balance energy security with investment into low-carbon technologies? On the 9th of May this year, Wood Mackenzie's Energy and Natural Resources Summit returns to Singapore for its sixth year. Join expert speakers and analysts from renewable utilities, transmission operators, investment entities, and technology providers. Join the conversation around Asia's renewable future. What's needed to bring carbon capture into the mainstream? How can the region balance growth with sustainability? And how can the huge potential of wind and solar be delivered? Visit woodmac.com/events to find out more and secure your ticket. Now, onto the show. Aviation accounts for just 2% of global carbon emissions. Yet it's a sector making concerted efforts to decarbonize. In 2023, Airbus more than doubled its use of sustainable aviation fuel, using over 11 million liters in its operations, in turn reducing CO2 emissions by over 23,000 tons. By 2030, the industry aims to hit 17.5 billion liters of SAF production. With significant support from the IRA, production capabilities can only increase. Today, we look at the developments in SAF production and how one company's methods of converting CO2 and hydrogen into hydrocarbons could reduce costs.
The fascinating thing people, I think, don't realize is that CO2 plus hydrogen to make hydrocarbons and water is a thermodynamically favored reaction. It releases heat. It was always known that you could do CO2 and hydrogen to make methane, but it wasn't until Tianqin's Nature paper was published in 2020 that showed that you could make the jet fuel range, and that really was the breakthrough.
Andrew Symes is a climate tech investor and entrepreneur focused on net zero technologies. He's founder and CEO of OxCCU, a company working to deliver a circular economy for fuels, chemicals, and plastics. What are the challenges with financing, regulatory support, and talent acquisition in the sustainable aviation fuel industry? And how can they be overcome? Let's find out. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And so give us a little bit of background on OxCCU. What is it exactly that you guys are developing?
Yeah, so OxCCU, we're focused on novel catalysts and reactor designs to convert CO2 into hydrocarbons, and we'll come on to talk a bit about that later. My own background, I'm a chemist by training, and then I joined BP. I worked in the trading team for 3 years in a variety of different commercial roles. Amazing experience trying to, you know, move oil and gas around the world and see the kind of scale of that industry. But ultimately, I've always been passionate about technology, and I left to join BP Ventures, which was corporate venture capital, so investing in clean tech startups on behalf of BP. Before I left to join a UK VC called IP Group, or now called Kiko, and we were focused again on investing in clean tech startups, mainly in the UK. I came across OxCCU and the founders, Tianqin Zhao and Jane, in 2020, just after the paper was published in Nature, and fell in love with the technology and the idea of creating hydrocarbons but without the climate impact. So I left venture capital and set up OxCCU along with Tianqin and Jane, and yeah, since then we've grown pretty rapidly. I mean, ultimately we have this huge need for hydrocarbons even when we get to net zero, and I think people realize this, but the significance of it is quite means we have quite a challenge ahead of us. The three sectors which I guess no one is debating that we need hydrocarbons for are aviation, particularly long distance, but also chemicals and plastics. And in those sectors, we have to have, you know, the combination of carbon and hydrogen. And I guess the first attempt at solving this was, of course, the first generation biofuel. But we've got real challenges with scaling that. And second generation biofuels, again, we've got challenges around aggregation of feedstock, but also around the conversion processes, because we've got a lot of different elements within the waste material. And so now, basically, we're really thinking about this CO2 as being the solution to the problem. CO2 does have these real advantages because you've got large amounts of feedstock available. And what we're focused on really is how you convert that CO2 once you have it into hydrocarbons. And that's the reaction with CO2 and hydrogen to form hydrocarbons. And we're really focused on the catalysis of that. So we're talking about making the conversion of CO2 and hydrogen more efficient and doing it with less steps.
And when you say less steps, how's that work?
So currently, most people who are looking at converting CO2 and hydrogen into fuel, in particular jet fuel, is the main target at the moment. They are focused first on turning CO2 into CO, so carbon dioxide into carbon monoxide, and that's a process called reverse water gas shift. And then they are looking at converting the CO with additional hydrogen via the Fischer-Tropsch process into hydrocarbons, generally diesel, jet fuel, and wax. What we have shown is possible, and this was really the breakthrough that was, over 8 years of work in the chemistry labs within Oxford University. What we've shown is that you can combine those two reactions into one reaction and convert CO2 and hydrogen directly into hydrocarbons. And that's a breakthrough because we can simplify this process. Simplified process means less capex, less opex, and ultimately a cheaper fuel based on CO2. And that's really the key, because ultimately at the moment, the barrier to adopting CO2-based fuels is the cost.
And this is a really interesting topic to me, because, I mean, we've talked a lot just globally about the electrification of the grid. But as you point out, there's a need for hydrocarbons into the future, even in a net zero environment. And obviously, carbon capture and storage underground is a hot topic. But you're actually talking about, rather than storing that underground for perpetuity, you're talking about reusing that CO2 into a process to help with a sustainable jet fuel.
That's right. I mean, wherever you can use electricity, renewable electricity directly, of course you should. You've got the efficiency benefit there. But there are many sectors where you need hydrocarbons still, even in a net zero world. And that's where you've got to ask yourself the question, where are these going to come from? And of course, yes, biofuels can play a role, but they are limited in terms of feedstock. And so that's where people are looking at converting CO2. Now, you're right, you can put obviously CO2 underground, and that is one solution. But there is also the option to use it. Now, you do need to be careful. I mean, if you're talking about biogenic CO2 or direct air capture CO2, then clearly it's a fully circular process and you can call it, carbon neutral. If you take CO2 from industrial sources, then it's a lower carbon fuel, but you still have enormous CO2 savings if you use that industrial CO2. You're essentially getting additional use out of the carbon before it goes to the atmosphere. And that's clearly, I think most people agree, a significant benefit than, currently where we get very, little or few uses out of the carbon before it goes there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned cost. As with everything kind of energy transition related, the cost is a factor. And how much does this process reduce, given the fact that you're eliminating a step that's currently in place and going to the one-step process? How much of a cost savings is that right now? And does it put itself on par with kind of the current cost of Jet A1 fuel? I mean, I assume that it'll continue to decrease as you scale. But how does that cost reduction right now put it on par with the current Jet A1?
The goal is obviously to get to parity with Jet A. It's going to take time, and we are kind of nowhere close to it yet. But with scale and with technology, I believe we can get close. Now, Jet A is also a complicated moving price, and we'll have certain taxes associated with it. And on the other side, you've got another kind of moving price with maybe some support. But ultimately, the fuel price will depend on the electricity price, which is obviously a very key input. The hydrogen price, which is obviously related to electricity and depends obviously on the electrolyzer technology, CO2 capture price, and then the conversion of the two to make the fuel. They're obviously the only inputs. And what we are saying is basically, yes, at the moment, the hydrogen price is key. You need a decent low electricity price or a PPA, you know, which fits with the green hydrogen standard, you need CO2 that's captured. That's less significant, but still important. But what we are saying is that the next bit is also very important. And I think all in chemical engineers, understand this, but you must have an efficient process to then convert the two. And that's CapEx in terms of not having, you know, lots and lots and lots of units, but it's also OpEx, you know, not having huge energy inputs into that process, but also, you know, using the hydrogen efficiently and making sure that all of the carbon, all of the hydrogen goes into the end product. You haven't got lots of byproducts that kind of waste your inputs.
And in terms of the SAF, how is that from an efficiency standpoint compared to Jet A? So is the equal efficiency, meaning the same mass in an engine can travel the same distance, or are there any other factors that come into play there?
To the Jet A is a very specific specification, and you know, a lot of the kind of e-fuel or bio components will, you know, need to be blended at least in the short term in order to meet the overall spec. But once you've met the spec, you obviously have exactly the same properties as fossil jet, and that's the beauty of the whole SAF industry, is that you do end up using the same pipes, the same trucks, the same tanks, and the same planes, and the same, you know, airport infrastructure, if you like. So that's the real kind of big advantage of it. Now, you know, if you want to get a drop in fuel, this is also possible, but you often will need kind of downstream processing units to ensure you have isomerized molecules rather than just purely straight chain, also aromatics. So there's a number of different downstream technologies you can use if you want to go 100% SAF. But at the moment, we are talking about blending it with fossil fuels in the short term, given the volumes that are available. Also, the spec may change to allow it to be more sympathetic to the sustainable aviation fuel components that are going into it.
Yeah, obviously a long way away from 100% SAF
yeah.
in a jet engine. So I think the opportunity going forward is really more of gradual blending with the fossil fuels and increasing the amount of that blending over time as the technology is proven, specs change, as you said, and the supply becomes more readily available.
Yeah, or co-processing. So, you know, feeding these components into an existing refinery unit and then taking it out, you know, as Jet A1, but you're feeding in a different input. You've got, you know, a bio component, an e-fuel component, or instead of fossil going into that. So that's another possibility. And to be honest, that does make a lot of sense. Now, we need to check that the regulation allows that, and it's quite a complex area there. But certainly using the existing downstream units for some of those final processes could make a lot of sense. You can aggregate different components that are maybe made more distributed.
And this is going to require a lot of support and input from regulatory authorities that currently are very involved, I would assume, on this initiative. How has that reception been?
I think there's broad support for SAF in general from, you know, the industry, the airlines, the governments. I think most people are behind it. I think it is a complex area, and I don't envy the regulators. It's a difficult job because you've got, you know, you're comparing biofuels, fossil fuels, and e-fuels. They've all got very different pros and cons, and it's not an easy job to get the right balance there. But I think they're generally getting through it now. I mean, the Refuel EU is now in law, and we're talking about 1.2% of jet fuel by 2030 to be CO2 derived, so power to liquids, and a larger component of that being bio-based fuels, so mainly HEFA, but also second gen biofuels. And then you know, when we go forward, we're talking 2050, they're talking about, you know, roughly 50-50, so 70% SAF, of which half of that would be CO2 derived. And I think, you know, other regulators will probably look at that and do something similar. I know the UK is, and the US, I think, is also, you know, looking at this as well.
Yeah, I love this topic, particularly around aviation. My dad was in aviation his entire career. My wife works for a major US airline. It's interesting to speak to her because she talks about a lot of the initiatives internally regarding clean technology, decarbonization, and SAF. And it's really good to see the industry support behind it as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of our investors is the United Sustainable Aviation Fuel Fund, which also has a number of other industry players, including Boeing and Honeywell and others, and many others, if you look it up. And I think it does show the kind of industry passion behind this, and they are, you know, they are very keen to find the solution. I think that from the customer perspective as well, I think people are more climate aware now, but they also are demanding, you know, the right to be able to travel and see people in other countries. There's something quite human about being able to travel, and I don't think people want that being taken away from them or being made prohibitively expensive so they could never do it, you know, never afford to do it. You know, all the evidence is pointing to more and more people flying.
Absolutely. The travel industry is not going away. And I would agree that more and more people are flying. And it's even more so now. Celebrities, politicians, you see getting hammered when they're using their private jets all over the place. And that's just not going to change. There's sometimes you need that efficiency. But what we need to do is get to a net zero on the travel side, just so that we can continue that, because a lot of things will shut down.
And to be clear, I mean, I don't think anyone is also pushing for completely unrestricted, you know, and if there's some demand destruction, I don't think, you know, what we would see that as a problem. I mean, if there's excessive use of flying where people could otherwise take more eco-friendly methods of transport, then I think that should be done. But even if there is a big push towards that, you know, then you're still left with a huge number of people wanting and needing to fly.
Yeah. And I think more and more people are taking more eco-friendly forms of transportation, or at least combining to what they can to reduce the impact on the climate.
Where you can use a train or an EV, you should.
Yeah, absolutely. And how far are you away from kind of building your first reactor and continue to prove the technology?
Yeah, so we're very focused on the catalyst and the reactor design, and we're proving the catalyst works at scale. And that's what we need to do, because ultimately our business is really focused on licensing. So we're selling the catalyst, we're licensing our whole technology package to a project developer who is putting together the CO2 and the hydrogen. And we need to persuade them that our route is the way to go when they come to procuring a catalyst and reactor design to convert the CO2 and hydrogen they've got into fuel. And that means that, you know, before we can get to that licensing, we have to demonstrate that it works at a decent scale and for good periods of time. So our first plant will be up and running hopefully in a couple of months in Oxford Airport. It's relatively small scale, but then we're quickly moving on to Sheffield, which is the Translational Energy Research Center, where we will do a larger scale up there. They also have up there kind of the UK's jet fuel clearinghouse, and we can do some testing on a jet engine up there. So that's really our kind of current scale up plan. We have one more plant after that that we'll look to do, and we're currently looking at a variety of different sites. And then after that, we can then look to license this worldwide.
And so you raised financing for this initial prove up of the technology. How is the receptivity to that? I mean, I know that there's money out there for the green initiatives, but as you were looking to raise the capital, was it a process that you found a tremendous amount of interest, a lot of support, people interested in it?
Yeah, we closed our Series A in May last year, so May 2023, led by Clean Energy Ventures, Boston-based US fund. We also had Kiko or IP Group, who did the seed round, and then we were supported by a large number of other corporates and investors such as United, E&I, Trafigura, Aramco, Bravos, Tech Energy Ventures, and Doral. And yeah, I mean, it was a tough experience. I don't think, anyone raising in 2023 found it easy. But we did, I think, get a lot of interest in our catalyst because people, I think, do understand that if we can prove this works at scale for long periods of time, then there is this benefit from doing it in one step. And I think that's what's got people's attention. We just need to now go and, you know, prove that it works.
And I mean, this is just one of those things that we've talked a number of times on the podcast about, is as we look to 2050 and beyond, that technology is going to continue to develop. Right. There are certain initiatives that can't quite get us to where we need to be, but it's under the assumption that technology will develop to a point that we can get there. And this is just exactly one of those things. You're taking a two-step process currently and evolving it into a one-step process that's going to make it more efficient, less costly. And this is just one of those developments that we've been talking about for a number of times that we need to happen. And so it's really good to see it is continuing to evolve.
Yeah. And I mean, the fascinating thing people, I think, don't realize is that CO2 plus hydrogen to make hydrocarbons and water is a thermodynamically favored reaction. It releases heat. It was always known that you could do CO2 and hydrogen to make methane. And there'd been some work that had shown that you could do CO2 and hydrogen and make very light olefins, so things like ethylene and propylene. But it wasn't until Tianken's Nature paper was published in 2020 that showed that you could make the jet fuel range. And that really was the breakthrough, because you were going straight through there in one step. And, you know, it's an example of where actually up until maybe, you know, relatively recently, people weren't taking CO2 utilization that seriously. But now the research and the effort and the time has gone into it. There is breakthroughs there that will bring down the cost. Now, we aren't the only part of the puzzle. You know, the CO2 capture side is also coming on, and that should come down in cost. The electrolyzer side, you know, that's still relatively-ish new industry, but it's scaling, and there's massive innovation happening there. And then on the electricity side, you're now getting, you know, enormous amounts of renewables deployed. There's a very sophisticated industry, you know, able to get you PPAs and able to kind of meet the green hydrogen standards in certain places, not everywhere. But you can see it all coming together. And then on the other end, you know, we make a hydrocarbon. We know what we're doing with hydrocarbons. You know, once you've made a liquid hydrocarbon, you know, there is a lot of work that's been done on converting them into the fuels and, yeah, the exact specs that you want. So I am pretty hopeful that this whole industry has the pieces that are all kind of coming together ultimately to be able to supply this hydrocarbon demand that the world needs, but without the carbon emissions.
Because the other alternative I spoke about earlier on CCUS is just taking what's been emitted and storing it underground, but there's still going to be the need for hydrocarbons. So it's reusing that CO2 to a more environmentally friendly initiative that's going to continue to bring down emissions to 2050, because they're aggressive goals, right? And these are the types of technologies that we need,
yeah.
Because it's not going to go down drastically enough over the next 25 years to where it needs to be without something like this happening to reuse the CO2. Because like you said, hydrocarbons are going to be used in jet fuel. So why don't we reuse the CO2 and make it more efficient? Because that's just going to accelerate the goals that we need to meet in 2050 and beyond.
Yeah, I mean, this comparison with CCS and TCU is quite complicated. I mean, I don't actually particularly like the phrase CCUS, because the two are very different propositions. What CCU is saying is, as a planet, we need to become more carbon efficient and value the carbon atoms that we have, especially the ones captured from the air, either, you know, via a plant, or captured directly. But even the fossil ones that we dig up, we should use them as many times before they go to the atmosphere. And we should run reduce fossil fuel demand. What CCS is saying is quite a different proposition. It's saying that we can continue to use and dig up and use them because we can put them all underground after use. That actually increases, arguably, fossil fuel demand. It's good for the upstream, whereas CCU would be very kind of good for the downstream. So they're quite different propositions and quite different pros and cons. I think, you know, CCS certainly can play a role. I think in the US, you know, it's definitely going to be happening there. But there are many countries where, you know, storing the CO2 underground is not going to be feasible, or it's going to be very difficult. And can you capture all of the CO2? Who's going to monitor it? Who's going to pay? What happens if there's a leak? What do you do with anything that comes out the other end of the hole that you put it into? Are valid questions that people need to ask. Now, on the CCU side, we certainly have other challenges. You know, where's all the energy going to come from? You know, is it fully circular? And the answer is, if you're using industrial, no. But it's very low carbon, and eventually we can move to circularity over time. But they are two very different propositions that I think need to be held, separately, in my opinion.
No, I'd agree with that. I think you probably said what I was trying to say a lot more eloquently, detailed than myself. But no, it's absolutely right. I mean, there's different. It's again just one of the different initiatives that that are being looked at. And my view is there's not going to be a single bullet for any of these different verticals within the energy transition. It's going to be multiple different technologies and initiatives that come together to achieve the goals that we need to. I mean, some people think, oh, well, we're just going to build solar and that's going to solve the world's problems, but it's not. And I think as you said, there's some places in the world where CCS is not going to be possible. That's not going to be an alternative for them. And so they need to have different technologies that are going to be able to help achieve the goals that they've set forth for themselves.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We need everything. Ultimately, look at where we are as a planet. You know, we need everything. It's not necessarily a big competition between all these different solutions, but they do sometimes need to be held separately because they do have very different kind of pros and cons, and kind of, you know, it isn't easy to compare the two, for example, with CCS or CCU. So you should look at them independently and see them having different pros and cons. Give them kind of different levels of support depending on, you know, the country potentially. But ultimately, you know, don't just all bet all your kind of eggs on one basket, because, you know, you'll end up with certain sectors that don't have a solution.
And what other areas is this technology, can it be applicable to? I mean, we've talked obviously about SAF, but any other areas that you could see benefiting from it?
Absolutely. I mean, We're focused on SAF because that's where the legislation is today, and that's where the kind of industry consensus and also the consumer pull to some extent is. But we're making hydrocarbons, and they are also needed for chemicals and plastics. So any chemical, you know, is potentially made from CO2, as well as any plastic, and this could move those sectors towards kind of greater circularity or at least lower carbon. You know, one example might be surfactants, for example. They also need to be decarbonized at some point.
The plastic, that's been a big question on my mind, is how we're going to address the plastics side of it. We've had a number of people on that have talked about recycling and initiatives that we can do on that front. But I think longer term, there needs to be something from that, because plastics aren't going away anytime soon.
Yeah, and they're very, very good materials for what they're, you know, designed for, and extremely difficult to replace with other things. So there is no easy solution there, and biodegradable ones degrade. So you end up with something that might not be suitable for what you're trying to use it for. But if, you know, you try and recycle as much as possible, then you're still left with some waste. You know, you'll probably end up having to collect that. You definitely can't have that go into the environment. And if you did burn it, then you could capture the CO2 and convert that back into more plastic. It's more work. I get that, but that is a circular solution.
And so you guys are, you mentioned, you focused on the UK right now, and building the plant and proving the technology at scale. And then you said going globally. So where are some of the markets that you think, let's go 5 years down the road when you've got it proven at scale, the target markets that you would initially look to expand into? I mean, I've got to imagine the rest of Europe and the US would be key markets for this.
Yeah, so we're focused right now on demonstrating the technology, but then we plan to license worldwide. So we plan to license to any project developers around the world who have projects where they want to convert CO2 and hydrogen into hydrocarbons, and they could be anywhere, but, you know, where are they likely to be? Well, there's probably two places where they're likely to be. One is places where there's good favorable regulation, at the moment the EU is leading that. But the second one would be places where there is a surplus of green electricity that otherwise has no use. So, you know, there is currently a plant in Chile, for example. You know, there's interest in plants in Australia, and some of these places have this abundance of green electricity, and no local demand. So that is another option, as well as the places with the regulation. So it's probably those two, but you know, generally we are looking globally, and I do think this is a global opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just given the global nature of travel, right? I mean, people are traveling farther distances more and more. All the planes that are coming out these days have increased distance associated with them. Part of that is, you know, they're obviously making changes to the weight of the aircraft, but I mean, they're becoming more fuel efficient. They're being able to travel longer distances, so people are taking advantage of that. So I definitely would see this initiative being accepted globally.
You could probably say that you could definitely say the hardest thing to move would be the hydrogen. So you want to go where the hydrogen is. The hydrogen is going to be made where the electricity is, and the fuel is the easiest bit to transport. So, if you think longer term, you know, globally, the places that are going to be advantaged for power to liquids are going to be those places where they have the cheap green electricity, you know, the grid that's green. And then the plant will be where the hydrogen's made, because you don't want to transport the hydrogen. And then you can move the fuel. But the regulation can mess with that. So, yeah, it's still to be determined.
Yeah. That's a great point on the hydrogen piece as well, from a location standpoint, because from a hydrogen market, there's a tremendous amount that needs to be built out from an infrastructure side on that. So the co-location you're discussing, it would be very efficient, at least to start up, because we've had hydrogen discussions on the podcast.
Yes.
And the amount of money that needs to go into building an appropriate infrastructure for that is enormous, and it's going to take a long amount of time.
Yeah, and I think all of the e-fuels plants, most people I speak to at least, are planning to build some variability into, or at least ability to kind of turn up, turn down on the plant, just because to meet the green hydrogen standard, we are going to need that kind of ability. Because that's the other thing to watch is, you know, you've got electricity coming in. The chemical processes do not want to be turned off for a week and turned back on for a week. And the electrolyzer may not either. So, you know, you've got to have some ability to turn up, turn down without kind of being able to can be completely turned off, whilst also meeting the kind of green hydrogen standard. Maybe that's via a PPA or not, or it's kind of behind the meter. But either way, you need some ability there, I think, to have some flexibility to meet the kind of cost and greenness, if you see what I mean.
And with the green electrification of the grid, in a number of different places, that initiative should help, because that's ongoing in a number of different areas. So hopefully that just expands the opportunity for this in multiple different locales.
Absolutely. And I think there are some countries in Europe where they're already quite close to meeting the green hydrogen standard by pulling from the grid. Whether or not it's cheap enough, that's another question. But we are getting there in some countries, actually, already. And in the US, you've got, you know, a huge number of projects with, you know, still waiting for grid connections. So, you know, you do think maybe there's an opportunity there in the US for those projects to shift to making molecules which can be transported more easily.
Absolutely. That's the topic on this podcast a lot, is, you know, the challenge with the queue for connection to the grid. It's challenging. A lot of different factors at play and very, very complex. But yeah, the queue is quite massive and slow moving. You know, we've always talked about a couple of the challenges regarding, you know, cost and some of the other areas. What other obstacles do you think are facing this initiative going forward, whether it be regulatory or just some governmental issues? I mean, it seems like there's a tremendous amount of support, but even with support doesn't necessarily always translate into action. So are there any other obstacles that you see out there that you're working to overcome?
We've covered quite a lot of the key ones. I mean, you need a pure concentrated CO2 source. You need an electrolyzer that works running on relatively cheap green electricity that's not going to turn off and turn on. You then need an efficient process to convert the two, and then you need some downstream. And they're the key kind of project, I would say, challenges. I guess other challenges would be, you know, supply chain, access to talent, engineers, access to sites, regulations around the sites themselves. Those are the other classic barriers to kind of deep tech, you know, or chemical engineering type technologies, and especially you know, it's challenging to compete in some of these countries which have stringent, you know, very stringent regulations and difficult supply chains.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. That's what I was thinking. But you mentioned the kind of talent acquisition side and development. I think that's going to be a challenge going forward because there's, you know, so many initiatives in green tech that require a lot of talented people. I mean, the good news is the younger generation are very interested in being part of the green movement, the energy transition. So they're coming up through the system already ready to go. But I think that there's going to be a huge amount of demand on that talent as these technologies develop and things get put in place in a lot of areas that are trying to prove themselves. That's going to be a drain on that. So I definitely think we need more of that, particularly focused on, you know, the educational system. And I think the interest is there from the generation.
Absolutely.
We just need to make sure that they're fully equipped and ample.
we really need the engineers, the chemical engineers. And, you know, one of the challenges I see that if chemical engineering is seen as oil and gas, and oil and gas is seen as something that people don't want to go into, we've got a problem because we need those same people. We just need them to do chemical engineering for the green world. And I do think it's a real issue that we need to kind of to address. We need to almost rebrand, you know, the chemical engineers as, you know, this part of the solution and not just see them as, you know, part of the old oil and gas world, because this has got to be the future.
Well, Andrew, listen, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking to us about OxyCU. It's really exciting. And I'm interested to see how things evolve over the next couple of years with, you know, proving the technology at scale and where we go from there.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
The Interchange is a Wood Mackenzie production. We'll be releasing the show every second Tuesday, so mark your diaries and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. I'm David Bandmiller. It's been a pleasure joining you. See you next time.